statistics, a long view and a long price. Spoilers will be commonplace. Listen at your own risk.
Good morning, faithful reader.
Welcome, fortunate seeker.
This is Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata.
Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata is a whirlwind reread of A Practical Guide to Evilware.
A very professional historian.
And one of the literature scholars of all time.
Tackle the big questions about one of the greatest novels of the age, such as...
Does anything happen in this chapter?
Is Price okay?
And what does accentless speech sound like?
This...
I trust people to act according to their nature. Anything more is sentimentality. Dread Empress Militia the First. So in this chapter, we get a dream sequence, which is always bad writing. Then Kat gets dressed, and then she starts a book club.
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary, actually. Nice job.
There was one lie in it, and it said it's not always bad writing because E.E. wrote this one, and E.E. has never written anything bad, ever.
I mean, I'm not going to be on a podcast that is going to take a significant portion of my life to do and say that he has written bad things. That'd be wild. So I fully agree with you.
Oh, but it would be really fun if we transitioned into being a hate podcast, actually.
I'm worried that by year 8 or 9 of this, we might.
At which point we'll have EE guest again.
Oh man, that'd be brutal. Anyway, so just in case anybody missed it, for those of you who tune out during the epigraphs because of how long they are, we got a little comment from Dread Empress Militia the First. It's not often that we get our epigraph from somebody who is a pretty important character in the story, and so it's always nice to see that. And it's cool to, you know, the Dread Emperors and Empresses show up here and there, so cool to see the current one.
I don't think she's going to last, though. She seems like a flash in the pan kind of empress.
A 40-year flash in the pan? Yeah, it's just a long flash.
How long can a flash be?
Before it's just a light?
Yeah. What, like, legally speaking?
So, it depends on how you're defining flash, I think, because... If you mean flash colloquially, very brief, like in the single digits of seconds, low single digits. But I think, and I'm not a photographer, I think you can probably stretch how long a camera flash is, and it's still a flash because the light produced by your camera or by other tools for photography is a flash regardless of length. So this chapter begins with a dream, and in it, we get a little bit of information about Warlock. Wakesa specifically, in case you're worried I was thinking about a different warlock. Not on screen in the dream, but we find out that he claimed his name recently, as of the time of this dream, by ripping the name out of the corpse of his hated predecessor. First of all, very visceral imagery, ripping it out of the corpse. Second of all, is this just because it's an evil sorcery-based name that this happens, you know, the usurpation aspect? At lowercase a, or can anyone just sort of rip a name out of a corpse if they're owed it, I wonder? Or is it just flowery language?
You know, I don't know most of the answers, but I do know it's not flowery language. That's just too good for it to be flowery language, and come on, in this book?
Fair enough.
And with this guy?
Also fair enough.
And in that country?
I'll allow it.
And in the same place as that thing that happened to High Lord Duma?
Oh yeah, Saba ripped his head off with her bare hands.
Wait, is she a werebear?
Nope, she did this... Yeah, okay, She did this without letting the beast out, Black tells us. Well, sorry. Amadeus tells us. I guess it's important to be clear here. I know that a lot of named probably can. Most martial names can probably do this because they get name juice. But it still sure is something to rip somebody's head off with your bare hands, I gotta say.
But she did it without letting the beast out, which shows how far she'd progressed in the mastery of her name. Which suggests to me, because it is not specified in this whole segment, that at this point, she is the cursed and not captain. Because while the beast still is a thing, for some reason, and I don't mean that in a I am confused, but rather I am uninformed. We know nothing. We never get anything. We get little tidbits to keep us hungry. E.E., release the docs. But if it's control of her name that's giving her control over the beast, then it should be the beast's name, which is cursed. Am I right, or?
Maybe. I was also, I don't know if it's instead simply that prior to having control, good control of her name, she would have needed the beast to do this feat, and now her name alone gives her the power. But I hadn't considered your reading, and it very well could be that at this point, since I'm not perfectly clear. I mean, yeah, I don't know that we know exactly when she was captain instead of cursed. So that seems very likely.
And at this point, we get an inventory of opponents and threats and possible obstacles on their way to bringing praise to heal.
Mm-hmm.
High Lord Mawasi is dead. Seneca's long buried. High Lady of Nock declared for them. Wolof may be behind High Lady Tassia, but she'd approach militia and cut a deal. And then we're told that the High Lady of Thalassina might have been a problem if circumstances had not intervened, because what passed for the Imperial fleet has been set on fire. But our perspective, our dream perspective, is Black's perspective, or rather Maddie's perspective, if we're being technical. And so there's a certain derision present that apparently he has. And I just think that's interesting. He says, what passed for the Imperial fleet? What are the current Black Knight's opinions on the Precy fleet, and how have they changed in the last 40 years? I'm honestly very curious. I know Praise isn't a great sea power,
mm-hmm.
but it's got a great port. What does he think about that?
Yeah, I read this when I just sort of took this to mean prior to the reorganization of Praise under Militia and Black, Praise's fleet was never worth anything, except probably in those moments where one of the Dread Emperors had this brilliant idea to have a massive fleet where everything's made of glass so that the enemy can't see it coming, or whatever nonsense.
Or a bunch of floating boats.
Let's not get out of hand here, okay? Let's try to keep it grounded in how, like, what would make sense in the setting. I know we have a lot of fun here, but...
Okay, I apologize.
So it may have just been that it was a neglected, small, you know, legitimately would have been worthy of scorn from anybody, not just Black here, or Squire maybe. But yeah, I guess I don't know what's happened in the last few decades, so it's a good question. Following this little summary of how the war is going, the Civil War, what's her name? Ranger, there we go. Ranger sneaks up on Amadeus and...
Yes.
Yep. And he gives us a little insight. He says one of these days he was going to be able to notice Ranger when she snuck up on him. And I know it's not like a major thing, but I enjoy the loose parallel here to Thief and the Lone Swordsman, how she has a distinctly stealthy name, and yet he finds her every time. And it's like a bit of a running thing. And here we have Ranger, who, you know, stealth seems like maybe a tertiary strength of the name.
But on Haisu, tertiary is still...
Yeah, exactly. But and their relationship is also more friendly than William and Vivian's.
How friendly was it?
Well, I guess we'll see at the end of the dream. But yeah, it's just a fun thing that the fighting guy and the sneaky person have this, there's this trope, you know, it's not unique to this story, of course. It is a trope of like, my friend who's a sneaky person always tries to sneak up on me, and in one of these pairings it works every time, and in one it never works.
Like the poor, who, if I listened to the news correctly, are lazy and therefore don't work.
Yep, nobody wants to work anymore.
And honestly, why should you? With what they're offering, you deserve better. There is power in the union. So Black is, I think, aspirational in wanting to notice Ranger sneaking.
Mm-hmm.
That it would be quite an achievement. But he doesn't end with that simple of a hope. Because When Ranger suggests she'll be displeased if he's not happy with this victory, he considers that in light of, quote, how often she still made a game of him when they sparred. And I know Black is very good for what he is and all, but what he is not an immortal elf monster. Half-elf, I know, I get it. I read this book, okay? I hear you writing in, don't write in. Nobody ever write in at thelongprice@gmail.com. But come on, how often she made a game of you when you spar? How about every time? Always? Forever? Am I wrong?
I mean, you are wrong in that you give Black more credit than he's due, or Amadeus more. You said he's pretty good for what he is. Last chapter, he basically admitted, actually, when it comes to personal combat ability, he's pretty weak when it comes to Black Knights specifically.
He's weak for being Black Knight. He's really strong for how weak he is. He's good.
He's crafty and capable and skilled. He's just not particularly personally powerful. So, yeah. The fact that he says how often, yeah. The Ranger wipes the floor with him every single time, definitely.
Oh, but wiping the floor isn't the only thing she's doing with him.
Oh?
Yes. Oh.
You mean the romance.
Yeah, the romance.
There's a bit of that that we get to see here, which is nice because it's the first time where these two are having a conversation that we really get to see in anything more than just like a discussion about a discussion. And we get a little bit of, insight into how Black does this. He says he'd not started to be attracted to High in that manner until he'd come to trust her as much as he could trust anyone. So perhaps the root of it was there. He's saying, the change in actually desiring another person for the first time. Cool. We get a little, we get a cool Demi Black or Amadeus, I guess not Black yet, insight. And it's fun to see him have this moment that feels like very young adult in its presentation. And, you know, and I really enjoy it here that I've just never felt any like this about anybody else. And this, it's cute, you know. As much as their relationship is something
monstrous,
this moment is cute. There's a change that's come over me, and as soon as I, you know, once I trusted her and fell in love, it's just great. I like it. It's a very sweet side of Black.
The old he was a boy, she was the only girl. What? Huh?
Hmm?
This is new. The classic story.
A classic.
Also, I apologize for nothing, but are you telling me that apparently Black is gray?
Okay. I guess so. So the other woman in his life that...
The other woman?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. All men are the same.
It's true. His closest friend, Alaya, now has the throne after this last victory here. And Ranger calls her that scheming freeloader.
Half right.
I don't know that there's anybody else within the borders of Praise who would call Militia a freeloader. Scheming, yeah, of course, absolutely. But a freeloader is very funny. The people who are around Black, in particular Ranger and Scribe, but to a lesser extent the rest of the Calamities, as we'll discuss a bit more next episode, just the down-in-the-mud opinion they have of Militia is so funny. She is... By all accounts, outside of the woe, one of the most competent people around. She is unbelievably skilled and brilliant and so good at what she's doing. And for several members of the woe, she's, you know, the guy that rode Black's coattails to the top. That's really funny.
Which is wildly unfair to her. I know she and Black fall out eventually, but up until, like, now, they've been a perfect couple. In the other sense.
Right. Perfect partners.
In the other sense.
Right. Alaya is Amadeus's work wife, is what we're saying.
And, you know, what do you mean by work? Because she had not taken to the field with them, and that was the last nail in the coffin for High. Great, except I know that not all Dread Tyrants are the same, by any means. And some are absolutely field takers. But even then, am I alone in getting the vibe that even if you're triumphant...
May she never return.
You're still probably taking the field, quote-unquote, up in your flying fortress, cackling as nightmares are thrown down. I don't think And I don't think Hai is going to even look too well on that. She seems a very down in the muck kind of woman. Like, if she wanted to chat with even the dead king, she'd probably just go over. I'm kidding. That would be too much even for her, I'm sure. But
right.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely. It's the name that Elia is coming into at this point, and probably only now has... No, this is... this. She's had this, doesn't she? This is consolidation rather than acquisition.
Yes, because she declared herself Dread Empress already, and that right. does mean something.
And they're referring to her as Militia. So the name that she has is very much a lead from the back kind of name. Even yeah, at the extreme cases, lead from the middle, maybe. it's not a Black Knight where leading from the front is sort of built into the name. But Ranger just doesn't accept that and just refuses to acknowledge that as being valid.
Well, I simply would be in the front and kill everyone. In fact, watch, I'll do it now. Want to see me do it again? That's your second Flash reference for the day through the unholy lens of Nickelodeon cartoons.
Yeah, that was really good. Black is frustrated with this whole thing, not with Militia or Ranger, but with the war that's been going on. All this death, all this destruction, just to confirm something I knew would happen 2 years ago. We've not improved the Empire situation in any measurable manner. And it's neat to remember when we are viewing things often through the lens of Catherine. And what I'm saying right now will come into sharp relief next chapter. But it's neat to remember that Amadeus legitimately wants for the Empire to be improved, for the situation of the Empire to be better. Like, he's not, well, once I have power, I'll be able to burn it all down more efficiently, or I'll be able to rest on my laurels, or I'll be able to launch my grand invasion of the sky, or whatever. Part of his...
Oh, triumphant was the best of them.
May she never return. Part of his thing is legitimately making the Empire function better, and not from a... not just in the evil sense, but legitimately as a state. And so it's nice when he brings that up and is legitimately frustrated when that's not happening. He has... you know, his goals allow for this. He does want a better empire.
But he... no, I was going to say he lacks patience, but that's not quite it. He has patience, but he hates to be forced to exercise it, I think. Because, in his view, all we've done is clean up the mess. But, like, dude, yeah, first you clean up the mess. And you know that. You're just being frustrated and venting to your girl. You got a girl.
I don't know that it's patience that he's struggling with. It's not the amount of time it's taking or the fact that there is effort. It's that it's wasted time and wasted effort. He's fine using time. He's fine setting a scheme in place with Militia that's going to take decades and decades to come to fruition. That doesn't bother him at all. It's this moment where for 2 years they have been doing nothing to further the grand goals aside from killing people who aren't as forward-thinking as he is, who haven't realized that Militia's rise is already set and done, and now he has to take time and waste resources and waste lives and all of these things that are now going to have to be rebuilt, so it's taking even longer than just these 2 years for no reason. And I think that's at issue here, is the waste rather than the time or the effort itself.
I hate to tell you, Maddie, but that waste is how you get the gig. It's built in.
Yeah.
It's not changing.
Yeah.
Sorry, fam.
Ranger
Either way, he's on the threshold now.
Okay. Which is what Ranger says to him. She is very supportive of his goals, even if she doesn't care about them, I think is the best way to phrase this. I don't think she cares about what the Empire is doing in the slightest. But she knows that he does and says... you've reached the threshold, Amadeus. You have the Empire. You have the Empire. You have your calamities and your armies. You've broken the old. Now you get to make the new. It's a very villainous take coming from Ranger, who is not a villain particularly. You have to break the previous thing to rebuild. You know, it's the same kind of thing that we get from Catherine for the next 5.5 books of this story. so it's cool to see the lines show up in this name dream.
Speaking of Catherine, she wakes up. just as things were getting really good.
Mm-hmm.
And she tells us, she communicates, the story says, deal with it. I was almost pathetically relieved I could still have dreams like this, that my name could still manage that much. And yeah, her name got messed up, her soul got messed up, she got messed up. But it's a conveniently bounded tattering, which also makes sense. I mean, take any disability narrative around, there are things that are just as easy or still pretty easy or completely doable in many disabled contexts, even though it's in the realm of the thing that isn't abled.
It also...
Or good days or good...
Yeah. It doesn't hurt that her surgeon is one of the most capable people when it comes to that kind of surgery in the all of Calurnia.
I mean, that does help.
Okay, it probably helps.
But he is a kid.
Yeah, but like, it's Z's.
Mages are better than people, as opposed to kids. So, right. This is kind of fun, though, because Catherine sort of... It's kind of easy to forget, I think, that a name dream is also sort of an eavesdropping on Black, because it's not just we're getting a story. Catherine's getting a bit of her teacher's literal life,
mm-hmm.
getting a whole eyeful of what he was up to. And this means she starts getting introduced to people Black dealt with without having ever met them. So she meets Lady Ranger, or at least experiences Lady Ranger, and is surprised to find out that she doesn't have an accent, which she'd expected given her foreign origins. But I supposed it made sense she didn't. She'd been around for centuries. And
didn't have an accent at all?
Right. And that's a cool thing, because I teach language. And the thing about language is, when you learn a new language, you very often end up with a foreign-sounding accent. That's simply how it is, because you don't have all the same sounds and you're not accustomed to making the same sounds in the same way, in the same order, in the same time, in the same combination. And a lot of that's kind of been baked in by the fact that you've been talking your entire life in, say, Mthethwa, and now you're speaking Lower Meetson. But the thing is, accent is also kind of malleable, but it has to be a deliberate and active thing. Look at any regional newscaster who has a heavy dialect for their area. If they want to move up in the world, they have to train themselves into something of a standard American broadcasting language. And I realized I said anywhere and then assumed standard American would be the standard, but yes, I'm saying the BBC should speak in standard American, but only if it's the English who are forced to do this. Everyone else is off the hook. No, make them go Welsh or something. Make them do it in Welsh. That all said, you can train accent stuff away. You can practice with it. No guarantees you can get all the way or not. No guarantees it will be fast or easy. But active and conscious work makes a big difference compared to just existing in a place in the language. Because once your language is good enough to communicate effectively and clearly, the incentive to change your language drops off significantly.
Sure.
And what I'm saying here is, Ranger, to drop an accent, I think even with centuries as a relative youthful person, would have had to make an effort at some point. And I think that's nifty.
So I have two things to say in response. First of all, one of her aspects is literally perfect. I don't think it took her that much effort to speak any language with the local accent. Second, Ranger's speech here, Lower Meetson, we think, right? Makes sense?
Maybe. I do not have my finger on the pulse.
Well, okay, we'll use Lower Meetson as the example here. Actually, it probably is. So she says no without an accent, with the implication then being that Prace's speech is the same as Kalos when it comes to dialect and regional accents. Like, whatever language, if it's Lower Meetson or... So, which is why I think it's probably not in Mthethwa. But that, like, Catherine would pick up an accent if she were speaking like a Prace person, but not a Kalowin. And here she's saying she's speaking it like us, like the group that includes everybody.
Now that's really interesting, because you're mad right. This Ranger is just that good.
Although that may actually, hold on, I say that may actually lend credence to the idea that she is speaking Mfaithwa here, because that isn't particularly spoken in Kalo, as far as I'm aware. So then she would be speaking it, quote-unquote, natively, and Catherine would recognize that, even if she doesn't speak Mfaithwa without an accent, without a Kaloan accent. So maybe that's what's going on.
Though also, natively is brings up,
Yeah, you know what I mean.
Because there are so many natives, right?
Yes.
Mexican Spanish is different than Peninsular Spanish, by far, which is different than Argentinian Spanish, which is a great time. But at the same time, my relatively standard American English is different from standard, or what, it's different than, what's the current term? SSB. Standard Southern British is different than anything in Australia. It's different than Filipino English or Indian English. There are wild differences, and you kind of got to pick one that you're speaking in, at least right now, even if you're bi-dialectal, which is a real thing, and awesome.
It's you pick one, or you end up with a blend of everywhere you've lived or every community you've been a part of.
Then you've made one, so you still picked one. Yeah. Checkmate.
Right, yeah, fair enough. It is important to remember, though, that picking one isn't always necessarily a conscious decision. Of the picking could be sort of just where you end up speaking. Not everybody has the time in the day to introspect on their idiolect.
So I do make a conscious effort to try to retain my regional features for my English, because, you know what, part of my story, and I'm proud of it.
And I do the opposite.
Proud of it in the sense of, like, you know, it's nifty having my story presence on my vocal footprint.
Sure.
My English is superior to some people's, because some people are three, and dang it, I do speak better than a three-year-old. But other than that, my English is not superior to anyone's. Goodness, sure. Grow up. The conclusion of the name dream suggested that after having broken everything, Black can build it anew. And Catherine stops to wonder, is this what applies to me? What have I broken? And I just need to know, my immediate thought here is herself.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
She'll break literally everything else, but right now, herself.
Yeah, get it together, Catherine.
She starts analyzing what she can make new. And she starts going through her army and trying to decide what she can fix. And decides most things she can't do anything about because she's lazy. But she starts with, what about a personal retinue? Well, the Galaborn are pretty nice.
Yeah, and she sort of, in this, you know, they're her personal retinue, perhaps, you know, down the line, but she uses that to also start broadly thinking about the 15th as a whole, and what it would mean if she took the Galaborn out of that hierarchy and all of these things. But she says in this that she needs to stop thinking of her army, of the 15th, as being a Legion of Terror that she's borrowing, and instead start thinking of it as the main tool in her arsenal. I don't know that I have any conclusions to this thought, or even middles to this thought. I have a thought. It is interesting to me how she is conceptualizing the 15th, both as, when she's referring to it as a borrowed legion and as a tool in her arsenal, as a private army. It is hers, and not just in the I command them sense, but I own them. It's borrowed, which means Prace owns it, but they're letting me use it, or it is my tool. And I know that she, at various stages in her life, is the commander-in-chief of varying sizes of military, of armies. And here she has the one partial legion. Thinking of it as hers sets it distinct from her long-term goal of it being about Kalo first. There's the wording here almost leans, for me, toward something that Kat is sort of, if not accused of, at least nudged towards, the idea that this is very much about Catherine as much as it is about Kalo. A lot of the things she does, there's like a selfishness built in. She's not thinking of them as an army that's Kaloan because she commands it, or an army that is for the defense of Kalo because it's under her, or for the freedom of Kalo. It is her personal army for whatever she ends up doing. And again, I think I want to I think what I'm getting at, or where my conclusion at this point is that I want to watch as this language develops, as she has more legions under her control, as she has the army of Kalo, all of these things as they continue happening, if the way that she speaks about her soldiers changes at all, if it stays the same in terms of, is it her private military force, or is she just in charge of it? And I know that nuance is pretty slim there, but it's the idea of a private army is definitely something slightly different. Prace is not big on that, and you know, or is big on that rather, until she gets there. I don't know. There's just a lot here when it comes to it being her personal military force, and I'm curious to see how that develops.
But it's also going to be complicated to watch it develop, because her situation will change so fundamentally and so much that as things change, whether it's directly relevant to this thought will become increasingly arguable, because it'll be a different everything.
That's very true. All right, then I'm just going to give up and drop this entirely. Thank you for encouraging me to not put in more effort into something that I need to.
Oh, I thought you meant drop the podcast entirely. I was really excited for the co-host tryouts.
you're not free of me yet.
I'm really glad to hear that.
So she then goes on to express concerns about the fact that Eris's soldiers are going to help her fill out her ranks. And rather than saying it's going to take a lot of work or we need to be careful about spies, instead she just says, I'm going to start killing them. She says, if anything, I'd do what I could to thin out their numbers in the dark. So there's that absolutely brutal pragmatism that Catherine brings to the table. Well, I've got more soldiers now, but I need to kill a bunch of them because I can't trust them.
But at least, like, they're Eris' soldiers, so Catherine's egregiousness is at least more expected from her.
Yeah, that's fair.
She always has a bit of a moral blind spot when it comes to Sahelian.
I mean, turnabout is fair play. Ubla has a moral blind spot that encompasses literally everything.
Really? Or does she have clarity? The answer is no. She has a moral blind spot.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty cut and dry answer.
So I spoke negatively of the way Catherine analyzes her army, and I'm going to explain that negativity a little bit now.
Okay.
She starts going through bit by bit. She starts with Juniper. First thing that makes the 15th different. But the Hellhound wasn't something I could improve on. That is not a productive viewpoint. Like, Juniper is extraordinary. Juniper is one of the absolute best, hands down, no doubt. So, you know, one of the best tools in my arsenal. Well, can't change that. Moving on. Just because Catherine's not better than Juniper doesn't mean that Juniper can't be improved upon. How about you go talk to her and say, Juniper, what can I do to enable you to do professional development, but in army terms, whatever they say
Marshall
for professional development.
Marshall development.
Yeah. Just don't do it in writing, or it might look like marital development, and then, you know, Bashar gets involved.
Yeah, you'd hate to see it.
I just don't think that humans and orcs have ever been as cute as those two, you know?
I think I agree.
But she writes off Juniper because she's just too good to be improved on. Hopefully she'll never break, otherwise it'll be Catherine's fault. Moving on!
Then she goes to next in her sort of list of tools here. What she wants to do is be able to have more tools for Juniper to use, sort of what you were talking about here, particularly specialists. And top of her list when it comes to specialists is, from the audience perspective, sensible, but from an actual, like, in the military sense, maybe Pickler should have been the top of the list, but is Robert. And she says a couple things here. First, Robert was one of the specialists because he was as much a vicious little goblin raider as he was a sapper. It might be time to take him out of Hune's Kabili and give him an independent command to mold in his image. So a couple things here. First of all, is it also very funny to you to realize that Robert is technically under Hune's command? Because that's very funny to me.
Yes. Okay. Next question.
Good. Second, I think saying that he's as much a raider as a sapper is underselling it a lot. I think Robert is first and foremost a vicious little goblin raider, and being a sapper just enables him to have the munitions necessary to do that. Am I wrong?
Robert is a nasty little guy, yes.
Okay, perfect. That's it. I just wanted to comment on him being nasty and on Hune having to deal with him.
And then as a final one sentence note in this paragraph, Catherine notes about Pickler. She'd shown she could handle the traps, artillery, and infrastructure aspects of the 15th in her station as senior sapper, comma. There was no need for her to have additional help in the matter. You are not currently in position to make that judgment. You at least should look at things. Like, yes, Pickler will ask for more, but, you know, hear her out. See what you can do. She's very good, but she is in possibly the most resource intensive feels wrong because it's alive, and she needs the most active investment of resources to be working.
Right.
Chat with her.
And on top of that, maybe she does need more personnel since she's handling traps and artillery, which she loves, and also infrastructure, which she also loves. But these are things that you need delegation for in a lot of ways. And while Pickler is getting these things done, while she's shown that she can handle it, there's no indication here that Catherine has checked in and said, hey, are you running yourself ragged doing this? Can I give you a second or a third or, you know, some lieutenants to help you out to make sure that the delegation is going well and that you can get these things done without killing yourself? It's just, well, things are getting done. I'm not going to look at that any harder.
And also, you say running ragged. Right now, that is the only way the 15th has operated, because you've had a rough time. It's not been fair to anyone.
Yeah.
You should be thinking, how will this work in a normal situation? How much longevity can I get out of things? Because right now, nothing is going to survive for another month. Dang it, Catherine. Which would be a good title for the series.
But after going through this list, which again is the Hellhound, one of the best military minds in Calurnia, followed by Robert, one of the best nasty little guys in Calurnia, followed by Pickler, one of the best engineers in Calurnia, her response, her thought is, wasn't enough. And then goes on to, what else can I do here? And keeping everything we've said in mind about help your people out more, on its base, those people that you just mentioned, I would argue would be enough. You're talking about giving Robert his own commands to mold in his image. So what we're describing here is Robert being let off the leash, a bigger toolbox for Juniper. I'm going to trust that combination of experts to do just about anything, actually. Yeah, help them out more, but saying that's not enough, Catherine, I don't know. It might just be.
Well, you'll have to read the rest of the series to find out that the answer is yes. Spoilers Great. Will be commonplace. Robert dies, though.
We've made it several episodes since you last brought that up. We were on a great streak. We need one of those signs of, like, there's been how many days since the last time Robert's death was brought up.
It'd be very funny to maintain one of those. Someone else do it. She starts wondering what she learned from her previous battles, and she goes through the long, long list, starting at Three Hills all the way through Marchford, which is both. And she asks, what had been my best assets? Which I immediately noted right here, Goblin Fire.
Yeah.
However, the next sentence turned out to be, the first time we'd fought the Silver Spears, the tipping point had been the Goblin Fire traps. Okay.
Yep, she knows. She knows what's up.
I felt clever by noting the joke, but it's actually the thing and she knows.
But
still
she,
clever, though.
She adds a layer to that. It's not just the Goblin Fire. It's also having Masego here. we get a very funny line about how Legion Doctrine handles mages and how you concentrate them to produce firepower rather than doing anything particularly tricky. And then we get, but Legion Doctrine did not take into consideration the fact that I had a mage of apprentice's caliber on my side. To which I have to say, yeah, obviously. you can't write the doctrine for a military and assume that every legion is going to have on hand one of the best mages alive. It's good that she notes this and realizes that she's operating outside the doctrine, sure, but it's still very funny that she mentions this.
But since she does have him, she wants to ensure that he has what he needs, and so she decides that she'll have to make an assignment of mages, several lines, permanent, as assistance to Masego's processes. And I realized, wait a minute, this is sort of kind of a prelude, actually. Because think about how the Hierophant starts working later on, when he doesn't have magic, and is one of the most magical forces around.
Mm-hmm.
This is a piece of prelude. Keep that in mind. move on. Something about mages. You have a point.
Yeah, Catherine is talking about Prace has more mages than anywhere else in Calurnia, and that Black had utilized that well by relying on formations of mages rather than individual talent or anything like that, including drawing on the sources of magic users outside of Pracy humans. She includes the rare orc caster who are pulled in to bolster the firepower. And then she also mentions goblin blood mages. I gotta say, I'm very curious. We don't get any extra information here, and we barely get any other information through the rest of this series, but my curiosity remains.
Gotta say, I'm kind of scared.
Of goblin blood mages? Yeah, it's probably awful.
Somehow I have the feeling that they already have my blood.
Oh.
And they're maging it right now. Well, of course, because this is Catherine, everything goes back to Eris.
Yep.
And she's pretty happy with the decision she's made now, because Eris may have been fond of using magic to solve her problems, but I had a named whose entire business was sorcery. She would not be able to match me in this, if I prepared correctly. And the thing is, I feel like she's still on the same delusional vibe she was when she saw Eris spell the demon away and said, I wonder if she could be a mage. No. No, I don't think she has magic. She's still unwilling to believe that Eris is, in fact, extraordinarily magically gifted.
And
you know, Apprentice has a better name for it, backing him up, sure, but this is Eris.
I mean, the thing is, he does to an extent, but we know from having read everything more than Catherine does, and in fact more than nearly anybody in this story does, actually, about what Eris means. There's a lot of assumptions built into that name. Obviously, she is heir to something, and what exactly she's the heiress of is unclear, but there are many assumptions, and what that actually becomes means that she does have a sorcery-focused name to an extent. It's just that nobody knows that yet. So even with Catherine's whole, she's not a mage thing aside, she wouldn't have known exactly how well Eris matches up against Apprentice, for example, in certain fields.
So she is a naive child, unwilling and unable to plan around the unknown.
Yeah.
Which is actually decent and good. But
yeah.
Everybody listening right now showed up for the mock Catherine Foundling at Power Hour. So, how about that Catherine, right? Pretty bad, huh?
Dragger, yeah.
But Catherine also doesn't get magic. The trick Masego had pulled with the hearths might have failed to kill the demon, but aimed at an enemy army, it would kill hundreds and break morale. Which isn't wrong, but also, let's think for a moment what that cost. All of your mage force, plus a lot of preparation, plus literally being in a city because you need all the hearths. Like, yeah, look into rituals and things you can do all together. But this really was a very situational thing, Catherine.
But if Z's can manage something approximating that, or that but a smaller scale or something, it's still very powerful.
Yes. Is it worth all your mages, though?
Yeah. So, it's interesting, though, because after she pulls together this idea, she hesitates and says, did I have it in me to deploy that kind of mass murder against my enemies, knowing they had no counter for it? So this is specifically referring to pulling a big bonfire down from the sky and incinerating a bunch of people. Hey, Catherine, do you remember the battle on those hills where you set up a big goblin fire trap and then your mage friend made fire snakes and blew up the entire front rank of an army in a couple seconds? Yeah, you have it in you to do that kind of mass murder against your enemies knowing they didn't have a counter for it. You've done it already. You'll do it again. Why are you hesitating here? You've already done it.
Catherine really likes to LARP morality briefly to herself.
Yeah.
She likes to LARP getting over morality. Catherine notes that Juniper drills soldiers into formations and suggests there's no reason that Masego could not do that with mages, but in order to use rituals to ruin an enemy general's day. And, like, that seems likely. Sure, really worth looking into. However, you're making things up again. You know nothing of magic. I know you don't. You never will. You are the worst. You should say, I wonder if there was a reason. Or, I should check to see if Masego could. And also remember, he's, you don't realize this yet, but he's not the best with people, or he will not be the best with people. So it'll be rough on them anyway.
Yeah, there's no reason you can't ask Masego about this, but... Hey, so as Catherine's going through the 15th and figuring out where she's missing things or how she can help it function better, she mentions that she doesn't have a general staff officer, the scouting and information officer, which she refers to as a cachera tribune. When words show up that are not English, I frequently look them up to see, hey, maybe we can get something interesting, like how Kabili can reference things like a number, where it makes sense, a part of a legion. This word only shows up in one way, and that's as a kind of underwear that some people wear. I wonder if it's just happenstance.
It's a religious underwear?
Sort of, yeah. At least a very cultural type. But it's very interesting to me that that's the case, and I'm curious, are we dealing with, well, it happened to be that, or there's more meanings to this word that I don't know, or did Prace name one of their positions after a certain kind of supply that they keep on hand or something? I don't know. It was just funny. I don't know if this means anything. I don't know if this matters at all. It was just an amusing little note.
Very interesting. I'll have you know, when I see words in the military, I just decide I'm not supposed to know them, because I'm not a militarier.
Fair enough.
Catherine tries to decide whether she can have an intelligence head like that, who it should be. And notes, my instinct for that was to put Hockram on the case, but Adjutant might not be the best fit there. And, you know, give it a few years. We'll see how you feel then, because turns out. And also, Prelude. We talk about Hierophant, we talk about Sego, who in the end has a bunch of mage batteries. Now we bring up Hockram in the view of intelligence, when at the end he has a bunch of little fingers, little bony fingers, on the case. I have a question.
Okay.
Yeah, I choose to do a lore drop about our bodies. I have a question.
Okay.
Do you have significant breasts?
I do not.
Neither do I, and I never have. And I just want to note, this sounds, based on my cultural background, like it would be a joke, but let's acknowledge, many men have significant breast tissue, even if we're only dealing with the cisgendered. Like,
oh, sure.
There's a lot of body diversity. But why I ask this is to note, I am not coming at this from a place of knowledge. I am a gay man who is not particularly breasty. But Catherine starts getting dressed. Because I remind you, what's happened in this chapter so far is she woke up.
Yes.
And she puts on her pants. She picks up the cloth roll for her breast bindings and tells us there might not have been much to bind, but the additional layer prevented chafing from the armor. She names a piece of armor, but again, that counts as a military word, and I'm afraid. So is breast binding a significant piece of preparing for armor wearing among the breasted?
I mean...
I know nipples can be sensitive. Also, I'm so American that after saying that, I had a moment of, can I say nipple on the podcast without it being explicit? But really no, it's okay. Just don't let any children under 18 hear about this.
Yeah.
They can't know about nipples.
Absolutely
those aren't for children.
Not. Absolutely not.
That's not their primary purpose or anything.
So this is an interesting one because it's hard to pull too much from the real world because historically speaking, most people who wore armor were not particularly endowed with breasts, just statistically speaking. Obviously, there are many, many, many exceptions, but...
Wow. Ancient world is sexist. Cancelled.
I mean... That said, I imagine in a world where there is much more equality when it comes to various bodies wearing armor, breast bindings are probably a standard part of the kit for soldiers with breasts, not for, I mean, sure, the prevention of chafing, perhaps, fine, yep, that's practical.
The reason Catherine gives.
Right, exactly, but also just, I mean, I don't want to, this doesn't need to be like a huge dive into anatomy here, but like, I don't know, just support for comfort,
oh, yeah.
You know? Catherine here wears it even though she isn't what does she say? That she doesn't have much to bind. But the implication there is, because of that even, that people who do have much to bind would choose to wear these for that reason.
Listeners, if you have any useful resources or podcasts or what have you that could teach me more about just how people deal and dealt with breasts in terms of like accommodating daily life, how much they affect things, I'd be curious. I'd like to learn. I have an extremely limited perspective right now. And snifty.
When you said listeners, I was sure the next thing out of your mouth was going to be, if you have breasts, and I was nervous about where you were taking our podcast.
Listeners, if you have breasts, please listen to the rest of this podcast. And if you don't, please listen to the rest of this podcast.
Wow.
Speaking of people whom I believe to have breasts.
So Catherine has this book from Black that has come up a couple times that has all sorts of numbers in it, and it's about price, and she's figuring out all the details. And she is struggling to figure out a certain column of numbers as we get here. And it says here that she had come close to asking Cucumber if she could make anything of this, but held back. And I know where this chapter goes, and this question is answered, but it is wild to me that in this moment she hadn't considered Hockram as the resource. Her reality-enforced right hand, sorry, her reality-enforced second, who is famously good at detail-oriented work, doesn't even cross her mind as the person to ask about this detailed thing, but rather her girlfriend who does magic?
Whom she doesn't love.
Sorry, yes, I forgot to mention that. Catherine does not love her girlfriend. We have to be very clear about that.
But even though she doesn't love her but does trust her, she wants to figure this out herself. And read Redwall.
Yeah, I love Redwall.
Where the cute little mouse has to solve a bunch of riddles to get the magic sword to beat the bad guy.
Yeah, Martin and Methuselah.
So I like the trope, don't get me wrong. Del Toro Quest is a great series of books, but the idea that you need to solve a bunch of riddles to be the hero, and also evil won't solve the riddles, but that's not relevant for the point I'm making, is a fun trope, don't get me wrong.
Oh, sure.
But why is Black presenting this as a riddle? Why is Catherine having to treat it as a riddle? Initially, sure. There's actually a great use in answering questions. It helps us learn. It helps us. But the returns diminish if you're spending weeks and months puzzling over something instead of dealing with the implications of the thing. Like, there's a reason.
Yeah.
I know more of science, I am willing to say, than Galileo. It's because I was told about it and asked questions, but mostly I was told and shown. And also, I'm not some chump. Take that, so, Galileo.
The first half
was right the whole time.
Got him. The first half about why Black didn't tell her, yeah, you know, if you'd take too long, the diminishing returns, that is discussed next chapter, so we do get a little bit of information there.
You're giving spoilers in a podcast without them.
Oh, my bad. But the rest of it, yeah, you know, it's Practical Guide to Evil. You got to have some tropes in there.
I enjoy it. I would not have picked on it if I wasn't doing this podcast.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But if you're going to spend 700, 900, 1,000 hours talking about something, you got to have more to talk about than just how much you love the thing for that entire time.
Like how erotic the scene is where you have a female character who's not in a full state of dress.
Yeah.
Please don't leave. I promise this is going somewhere with the point.
Hockram comes in after,
yes,
to be clear, knocking and getting permission to come in. And he's very uncomfortable with the fact that Catherine is, partially exposed. And by partially, I mean, like, if I had to guess, her shoulders and part of her abdomen, because she is, again, wearing breast bindings. So he's very uncomfortable with this, and Catherine pokes some fun about, I'm just too much woman for you to handle. And Hockram responds, he sighs and says, yes, your strangely colored thin skin and lack of proper canines has me all aflutter. Please cover up before I can no longer control myself. It's great. These two are cuties. It is wonderful. They're just pals palling around and making fun of each other's bodies, or rather, one of them's making fun of the other person's body. And that's great. That's what friends do, you know?
And also what strangers do sometimes, which is wildly inappropriate, stop commenting on people's bodies.
Yeah.
If you say you've lost weight and you're not a medical professional or expressing concern to a close loved one whose health you are involved in, stop.
Or you don't have to be expressing concern if you are friends with someone who is actively, publicly, vocally saying, I'm trying to lose weight. And you say, hey, I've noticed you lost weight. Nice job sticking to your goals or achieving your goals or whatever. That's fine.
Sure. Even then, it's dangerous ground because who knows?
It is. Which is why I stick to doing this with very close friends who you have the kind of relationship with where that's appropriate. And in case you need to be told, that isn't with strangers or extended family that you see rarely. Like,
so everyone listening, I've been watching you, and I gotta say, the way your bodies have changed lately is fantastic.
Yeah, it is the official stance of this podcast that we love all of our listeners' bodies.
Looking good. Can you be sued for radio harassment? Actually, that sounds like something that's probably a law against.
Oh, I hope we can't be sued for radio harassment.
Listeners, if you're a lawyer, help us.
Side note, I learned today that my parents have started listening to bits of this, so I may have just said that I love my parents' bodies.
I hope you do. They brought you into this world.
Sure, and they can take me out.
They can take you out.
There it is. So, Cap is in this moment. So, Captain is in this moment with Hawkram, and he notes that Hawkram is pretty popular with the other orcs. That other orcs are often, the line she uses is giving him the eye. And then she says, fighting multiple heroes and being the first of his species with a name in centuries was, and here's a fun word that she uses, apparently kind of an aphrodisiac for his kind. The word apparently is usually used as a indicator of skepticism or surprise, maybe. And then to say for his kind specifically, listen, Catherine, I think being the first of your species to have a name in centuries probably works pretty well for any of the species of Calurnia. Acting like this is some weird orc thing is very strange.
No follow-up on that. Yeah. Yeah. So Hawkram notices she's got a book, and Catherine tells him it's just on loan, and Hawkram says, I do not mean to pry, which is a great way to pry. Hawkram knows how to do it, because come on.
And Catherine recognizes and is willing to... Okay, sorry, before I finish this, she clenches her fingers and unclenches them. Number 21.
Woo!
She recognizes this and is begrudgingly willing to invite Hawkram into her special riddle that her mentor gave her. And he picks up the book, fingers through it a little bit, frowns at the pages, flips back a page or two, and then just rolls in with the answer. Just instantly, which is, by the way, the number that she was struggling with is the total land area of the empire that can bear crops. But the important thing is Catherine's been struggling with this and considering help and not sure what to do. Hawkram picks up the book after politely implying that he'd be willing to help out and spends, if I had to guess, 30 seconds looking at it and solves the problem. He's great.
It does help that he has local information, which is obviously going to help. Like, if you're from the place, you know more things. It's like the way that colonial settlers discounted the knowledge of indigenous peoples and then died over it because they just didn't have any willingness to engage with their knowledge, even when it was given, because they're chumps.
It also,
people know things about where they're from.
Right. It definitely helps to have a native here. It also, well, kind of, I imagine Hawkram's actually from the steppes, but...
Yeah, you know.
Closer. But it also helps that Hawkram probably came into this with an open mind and was willing to look at this and understands pricey food stores maybe better than Catherine, because when he provides his answer, Catherine's response is not, oh, I hadn't thought of that, but rather, that doesn't make sense. She wasn't going to get to this because she was coming into it with the wrong preconceived notions for what was possible. So she wasn't going to find this answer on her own. She had prevented herself from doing so by bringing the wrong context. So yeah, having Hawkram here just made it a little easier, for sure. And Possible.
Also possible.
Yeah.
Catherine is unable to get there because she doesn't really factor in how blood sacrifice make crop grow good.
Mm-hmm.
Which, fair. I'm glad you don't default to thinking that. But the number in the column is bad because the food needed for the empire is way too big. Otter alone, she tells us, is 500,000 citizens, which is wild. Like, that's disgustingly huge. 500,000 citizens? I have lived in a number of places in my life. Also, I have new frickin' York City, if I may be so crass, but I am walking here. None of them have been over 500,000 citizens, because that's a big, chonkin' city today. In full medieval era, how many 500,000 cities are there? Otter? And? Well, maybe Lys has 500,000 people, right? Like, it seems like it's a good city with a lot of happy and healthy people, families and children.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, Stalia, almost certainly.
I'd hope so.
And did you say on Calurnia?
I did.
Okay, so then that narrows it down, because I bet a bunch of dwarven cities have it. According to the
drow cities.
According to the wiki, Stalia has at least 1,000,000 people living in it.
Oof.
And that's the summertime population, and it's more during the winter. So,
I mean, that's not unachievable by any means.
No, but it's a big one.
I know that. I'm going to look it up before I say no.
While you're looking it up, also the free cities may actually be very, very large because they're city-states, so they would have a pretty focused population, sort of. You may have some pretty heavy population numbers down there.
Okay, I found the context in which I have got my fact. 1,000,000 might be possible, but that's so huge because I studied Spanish in college, and part of that was history, and it involved the terrible and horrible colonial histories during the conquest of the Americas. Mm-hmm. Awful stuff. The Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan had 200,000 to 400,000 people, which is obscene, at least from a Western perspective, because only Paris, Venice, and Constantinople could have rivaled it in Europe at the time. It's comparable to 5 times the size of the London of Henry VIII, who is terrible.
Wait, was one of the things on the list Venice?
Yes.
Hey, don't have so many people in Venice. Don't have that city. That's too many people for Venice.
Venice is quite a place.
Listen, it's beautiful. I don't have a problem with the people who live in Venice. I don't have a problem with Venetians. Venice is like Las Vegas, but the opposite problem. There's the wrong amount of water there for people to live there.
Listeners, having been to both, Venice is more amazing, but go to Vegas. It's one of my favorite places. I don't do casinos. I love Vegas. Also, Vegas is so beautiful.
Also, traveling to Vegas, by and large, is in and of itself, discounting any activities you may get up to, is much more ethical, just broadly speaking. Don't go to Venice.
Catherine comes to the conclusion that the implications of Prace being hungry all the time are big.
Whoa.
She says, if from generation to generation starvation remained a constant, it would leave lasting marks on the mindset of the Prace. I said this very early on. I just want to point back towards me being right about everything always, all the time. But one thing I enjoy about Practical Guide is it's a fantastic world with unbelievable things, but at the end of the day, it still is something of a materially realist story, especially here, because good and evil and great kingdoms and honor and glory are all fine and good, but nothing matters as much as the food you put on the table, the roof over your head, and the safety of your children. And Prace does not have two of those.
Oops.
They have some roofs, though. And they got some gates in a really big city. Have I ever mentioned how big Otter is?
It may have come up before, yeah. I don't remember. We've talked a lot. In fact, perhaps too much? Well, let's not get carried away. We've talked exactly the right amount for this episode because that's all the time we have for today.
Join us next week on Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Erratics. We discuss
grain,
games,
and glory.
Wade in their blood. podcast, guys, talking Erratic Errata. It's a fan-made podcast discussing Erratic Errata as a practical guide to evil. Check out the full serial at practicalguidetoevil.wordpress.com. Intro music for this episode was Cradle of Your Soul by Lemon Music Studio. Music for the epigraph was Clava Cimbalo, late Middle Ages music from the 16th century by Julius H. Outro music, which even now is lifting my voice to the realms of the divine, is Price of Freedom by Good B Music. The music is provided by the generous license of pixabay.com/music. Go and support all the artists who make this work possible by providing their stories and sounds free of charge. If you'd like to support this podcast, follow us on Twitter at TheLongPrice. Do you have questions, comments, or contributions? Are you overwhelmed by the urge to correct our errors? Email us at TheLongPrice@gmail.com. If you'd like to materially support our work, find our Patreon at patreon.com/PGTEE. Join the ranks of our patrons and be called by name, receive personalized stories and art, and get a number of like little extra files we put up there. Hopefully there's a new one up today, but I'm not the one who uploads them, so take it up with the co-host. We implore you, don't consider joining unless you're already supporting all the artists who make this possible. Special thanks to our patron villainous hero Gray, our patron Liege, the claimant never the named, our patron guardian, the Fey Knight, our patron and mentor, the traveling teacher, our patron and dear friend, Aaron, our patron and inspiration, the hopeful romantic, as well as the hordes of cattle below. Next week, chapter 36, Madman.